welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rea, and I am joined for the purposes of this intro by my colleagues David Holmes and Zara Turner. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
That was far more coordinated than the live session where you spoke over one another. So well done for that. Zara joins us once again this week because we did part two of our top 10 challenges faced by DPOs. As you may remember, the way we came to those conclusions of our top 10 were to look at the numbers associated with the queries into our support desk function. We looked at some stats and we picked out some of the most commonly asked, frequently asked questions, what topics those related to. And then we've translated that effectively into, you know, what challenges does the DPO face, or the privacy officer, or the governance team, whichever you may be. What do you face? How do you, you know, overcome those challenges? And maybe just talking around them a little bit. So yeah, Zara shared some insight with us in relation to that, didn't you?
Yes, indeed. So in today's session, we covered other rights requests, lawful grounds of processing, privacy information, CCTV, international data transfers, and direct marketing. And there's a lot of really interesting discussion, especially around lawful bases, CCTV, other rights requests. I mean, it's a really great discussion. Also, we touched on some recent cases as well that have come out of enforcement action from the ICO, like with EasyLife. So there was a lot to discuss and unpack today.
Bumper session. I was going to provide the segue into talking about the news, and I was going to ask Dave about it, but you've done it for me.
You're welcome.
No, for sure. And I quite enjoyed the cases because it's definitely worth reading them. Pick them up off the ICO's website under the enforcement section. Have a look, because it's one title that I might be looking at for this session is Cheap Excuses for an Easier Life, but I'm not quite sure whether that should be watched.
Unfortunately, we don't need a title because it's a theme session, but if we talk about it next week, you can use that one.
And we'll bring it back, yeah.
We'll bring it back.
But some of the excuses were poor, though, weren't they, when we looked at them? We won't go through all of them, but some of the excuses were really poor, and very much kind of trying to grasp the last straws, weren't they?
Very much so, very much so. And speaking of future sessions, we're of course going to be back next week with more content. Next week, we're very excited to be joined by longtime friend of the podcast and contributor Barry Malt. Barry is a fantastic guest. For those of you who either know him personally or have listened to episodes before, he's really great to have on, a bit of a straight talker. You know, extremely knowledgeable and very experienced. And he's going to talk to us about the Data Security and Protection Toolkit, DSPT, obviously the requirement on NHS organisations and other healthcare providers to complete it. So that's going to be very interesting. There's a new version of that out. There are some changes happening. So we're looking forward to speaking to Barry about that. If you're in healthcare, you'll want to come along to that. And even if you're not, it'll still be interesting to see how self-assessment questionnaires and self-auditing governance from that perspective might happen. So I'd seriously recommend that you come along. In the meantime, we're also looking at some bonus content for you all. We're approaching the century of episodes and we're just so excited to get there that we're going to push out some bonus content. And we're looking at, I think we've settled on Diary of a DPO, which is maybe a bit cheekier, so hopefully Stephen Bartlett doesn't come after us. I'm sure he won't mind. But Diary of a DPO, we're looking at a three-part series speaking to some of our key stakeholders here at DPP, just like Mr. Holmes notably, and then some other voices you may recognize, our very own Phil Bryan, but also some that you may not. A couple people from around the business, David Hendry may also be joining us. And the intention behind that really is to look at the journey of these three people. You know, how did they get into data protection in the first place? What brought them here and what kept them around? We think it's going to be really interesting to get some of those perspectives, because we often acknowledge the fact that people in privacy come from very different walks of life. Sometimes they come from different roles. So we thought it was worth expanding on that. So, yeah, we're going to be doing a bonus three-part series. Well, we're going to talk to some of our colleagues here and speak about their journey. I'd ask you, Zara, but your journey is almost identical to mine. So it's maybe not quite so interesting, but we're certainly looking forward to that. So stay tuned. That'll be out on all of our socials. We won't do those live. We'll pre-record them and put them out as bonus content. But if you keep an eye on the socials and subscribe to the podcast on any audio streaming platform, you'll get that as soon as it goes live. Right, I've got another meeting in 5 minutes, so I'm going to have to bounce. Dave, Zara, any closing thoughts before we let the listener get into this latest episode?
For me, just simply enjoy. I thought it was another fun-packed and full session.
Indeed, me too.
Lovely stuff. Well, in that case, we'll let you enjoy this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. News items, because Dave and Zara have been quite... Well, I don't want to use the word overzealous, but, you know, there's been quite a lot of preparation. So, Zara, do you want to give us your first news item then?
Yes, sure. So there's been a big case with EasyLife, who have been fined a total of £1.48 million by the ICO for a breach of data protection and electronic marketing laws. So what they do is EasyLife sell household items and some services and products. And they, with this information, they do some profiling. So, for example, if a person were to buy a jar opener or a dinner tray, they might then from there infer that that person might have arthritis and then call the individual to marketize some products which may be of use to an individual who suffers from arthritis. So the ICO investigated this and found that basically the company's actions of, you know, making assumptions about their medical conditions and marketing such products to them without their consent is just, you know, it's not on. It's invisible processing. It's not making people aware of what you're going to be doing. And also, quite interestingly, 80 of their 122 products that they sell were deemed to be trigger products for such profiling, which is huge. So for that profiling, they've been fined £1.35 million. And then for the calls to members of the TPS, they've done 1,345,000 calls, which they've been fined £130,000 for. So a big sum of money has been fined for EasyLife, which is, yeah, it's quite staggering, really. I mean, it's pretty poor. Also, a lot of what they've been doing really is targeting, you know, vulnerable members of society for these products, and it's pretty poor to see, really, from companies.
Yeah, it's not great. It's not great. Interestingly, yeah, Dave.
I was just quite interested in it. Is it an actual fine? Because I've seen the headlines, but I didn't know if it's an actual fine or an intention to fine. Because sometimes we see the intentions first, don't we? In that sense, especially in the high numbers. Remember, like with British Airways and that kind of thing, and Marriott, where it's an intentions fine. Is this an actual fine? Have they actually? Is that gone through? Is it the stage where they can still dispute it?
I'll be honest with you, I'm not entirely sure. Considering that there are mentions of it being appealed, I wonder if it's actually been handed down outright as opposed to an intention. But I'm not entirely certain. I don't know if someone who's here with us live has got the information and wants to add to that, or Zara, if you know. But as far as I'm aware, I think
it's happened. I think it is an actual fine, but I'm not. Don't hold me to that.
Okay. So that's where we are with it. I mean, yeah, you know, I think Zara's given us the summary. Okay, there, Dave. Yeah. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add to that. I mean, it is poor. Well, interestingly,
I think it's just quickly on that. I think it's poor, but I think it's poor because it's relating to health data and making assumptions about health and marketing products based on health. Because don't forget, most marketeers will have trigger products. If you go and buy dog food, they'll maybe assume you've got a dog. That kind of thing. But it's not the same as assuming that you've got arthritis because you've opened a tin opener. You've got one of those easy can openers, sorry, in that sense. So I think it's probably all related around privacy and health information rather than the fact that they're just trying to find products that individuals may be interested in.
But also, you then, I get what you're saying, which is that in theory, the infraction is the same potentially as a number of organisations will be doing. But there's a different emphasis when you're talking about specifically targeting people who you think may be vulnerable. That's surely got to be, you know, consideration in that respect.
I was going to say for sure, but we've seen other. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with it, but obviously marketing can only sell stuff to people who may be interested in what they're trying to sell, and therefore they need to find some ways to identify those individuals to sell the products. Here, like I say, it's dealing with health information. Don't forget that a while ago there was similar implications regarding certain life stages, that kind of thing, and what people may go and go through, start and stop, and selling items around that. You remember there was like a pregnancy advisory, or there was they had a kind of a support pack for new mothers, weren't they? And they were found in difficulty as well as consequences of what they were doing with processing data and trying to target people. So I'm not necessarily saying I agree with it, Beckham, but I think it's that targeting based on health information that's probably the crux of it for me.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, I suppose you're right in the sense that a lot of this does go on. And one of the things that's interesting, I saw a lot of commentary. I can't claim this is my own opinion, it's someone else's opinion, but I've seen a lot of commentary around this, which suggests that, sorry, just getting some feedback, bear with me. I don't know where that's coming from. There we go. I think that's gone. I've seen a lot of commentary around the fact that, so the respondent in this case, Easy Life, basically have said, you know, what our intention, and I think this is a particularly shallow argument, but their intention is to make fewer calls, which are more targeted to customers, as opposed to indiscriminately sort of bombarding everyone with less targeted marketing, and therefore they're going to be disturbed more by more calls. And sort of their attempt to spin this has been that it's ultimately in the interest of the customer because they're getting things which are more directly targeted at them. But I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, Dave, but it seems like it's grasping at straws, really.
I think it's a rather loose argument, personally. Only based on the fact that they're trying to say that don't want to do indiscriminate marketing, but surely unsolicited marketing is indiscriminate by its very definition, possibly. So I think they're just grasping at straws. I think it's a rather loose argument, to be fair.
For sure. Well, without wanting to spend too much time on this, because we probably could, but I'm conscious that we've got a lot to talk about today, so I just want to make sure that we get to that in good time. There are also a number of other fines that have been handed down or signalled. Again, I'm not entirely sure what stage they're at throughout the course of this week. But effectively, the second batch, if you like, Zara, relates to a number of schemes which, again, potentially targeting more vulnerable, sometimes elderly people. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it all seems to centre around a number of companies that are effectively selling double glazing.
Yeah, there seems to be like a big crackdown on industries. To be fair, a lot of this is enforcement action from calls that have been carried out in like 2020, 2021. But yeah, there's a lot of double glazing places, some installation places, insulation places as well that have been being called out for this. And I wonder if that's just from a movement that there's been a lot of work towards with government schemes to getting people aboard to insulating their homes and stuff, and people have taken advantage of that and kind of gone a bit overboard. When I say people, I mean organizations, of course, but gone a bit overboard with their marketing strategies, and this is the ICO kind of cracking down on that, and you know, making sure that people, when they are calling people, that they're screening against TPS as you have to do, essentially. But it's interesting because I just wonder, is this a case of they just can't be bothered to screen against the TPS because they're like, well, what's the chances of getting enforcement action? Or is it a case of, you know, they don't know that they're meant to be doing this? I don't know. I would probably think it's the former of just wanting to be able to get on with it and not really caring about the repercussions.
I think you're being far too polite. I think it's a deliberate trying to circumvent PECA, because PECA and the rules around TPS have been around for years. It's not a new thing in that sense, and ignorance of the law is not defence. So sorry for taking a harsh stance on it. There's too much of it. It should be known. If you're buying data from data providers, they should be assisting with your due diligence around the data and ensuring that you've only got records that are clearly screened against TPS and available for use. If you actually dip into them, I know we haven't got time, so we want to go on to the main part of the point for today's session. But if you, it is definitely worth reading, because the reason why I say I think they're circumventing and take them over a harsh line is you only have to actually read the ICO's guidance and some of their defence, and some of their defence is pretty poor. So one of the ones that's been fined recently by the ICO is EcoSpray installations, and they didn't have call line identification in place, which is a requirement if you're calling people so they know where the number's coming from, that kind of thing. One of their arguments to that was, if I can just find it here, just quickly looking through it, that the reason why they withheld the number is because they only had one telephone, inbound telephone line coming into the office, and it would stop them being overwhelmed by incoming calls.
Well, I mean, that's, I'm trying to think of a polite way to put that, but that's complete and utter nonsense.
You know what I mean? Absolute. Some of it is just absolute nonsense. So they're definitely worth reading. If we're not got a great deal of time to talk around some of these cases, which is understandable, definitely go and read the actual judgment, see what the ICO said, see what their defences were, and if you think I'm being harsh, maybe make up your own opinion. But some of the evidence and some of the defences that they come back with would be rather loose. So, for example, I think EcoSpray suggested that they purchased some data from a data provider where they made 90% of the calls that they made had come from this data provider, but the ICO couldn't really find any evidence of the data provider in existence other than that on Companies House, and it was dissolved in December 2011.
I think you're probably right, and Mark has taken the words right out of my mouth. Utter rubbish is what that is. Just before we move on, Cara has very kindly shared a link to the case law you were, or the enforcement action rather, that you were mentioning a minute ago, Dave, in relation to those new mother parenting packs and all that. I was trying to place what you were talking about because it did ring a bell, and yeah, it's this bounty, not the same as the coconut based confectionery, I'm sure, but it was this basically scheme where, you're right, sort of expecting, and new mums were targeted with these packs and then signed up to some sort of marketing database off the back of it. We did speak about this on a past episode. I'll be honest, I can't remember when, but presumably around the time it bubbled up.
Yes.
But it was really, really interesting for a number of reasons. I thought you were talking about, in all honesty, there was a case in America a couple of years ago, which related to Target, I think, or Walmart, one of the big ones, where a young lady had been targeted with sort of new mum paraphernalia in a marketing database because she'd been making purchases that indicated to them, based on their side, that she might be expecting. And it had caused a whole hullabaloo because then it had come through to the family email and she hadn't told anyone yet. Do you remember that?
Now you mention it, you do.
Vaguely.
I do remember that now. I was actually, and thank you for, Cara, for putting the link in. I just couldn't remember the name, so it's...
it was Walgreens, apparently. Thanks for clarifying.
So thanks for Cara for putting the penalty notice in the chat. That's the one I was thinking of. But now you jog my memory with the other one as well. So two cases in that sense.
Renisha saying, I was one of those mums 18 years ago. Can't believe bounty is still around. Well, they're not, and that I think is part of the point of the recent, because I think there was some. So I think the reason it came up again. We'd have to go back and listen to the previous episode where we spoke about this. I think the reason it came up is because one of the couples did try and sue them, but they'd gone out of business in the meantime, or they'd been dissolved or whatever. And so they tried to sue the hospital because I think part of the scheme was people would infiltrate the ward and try and get mums who had literally just come out of labour to sign up to this thing, which is extraordinary. And so I think this couple were trying to sue the hospital on grounds that they shouldn't have been allowing that to happen. I think that's the reason it came up again quite recently, but they have, I can confirm, they have gone bust or been dissolved or whatever, they no longer exist. That's how they got you. Christ, sorry to hear that. Interesting. I say we did speak about it, so if anyone's interested, we'll try and find the previous episode and link it back, because there's some really interesting things in there about how you approach this type of enforcement action. again, I'm now the one at risk of derailing us from our topics, despite the fact I spent so long trying to make sure that we stay on track. So just to jog everyone's memory, so we are talking about top 10 challenges faced by DPOs. This is based on, for those of you who weren't with us last time, we came to these conclusions because obviously we have our support desk function, which Zara broadly heads up alongside me. And effectively, this is a, you know, support desk like any other. You write in with your queries, etc. I've got a contract to review. I want to share data with whoever. Could you help me? X, Y, Z. And because we've built it in Salesforce and our CRM, everything is tracked. And so we're able to periodically tap into the numbers and see what comes out as the most popular topics. And so we did that. And in fact, I'll just share my screen quickly for those of you who are with us live. Again, if you're listening to this back and you're not able to make the live sessions, I would encourage you to try and come and join us because this is where it all really happens. Hopefully I'm not sharing anything I'm not supposed to there, but you'll see here some information on the numbers that come through our function. And we spoke about the top ones on our previous episode. So we spoke about subject access requests, data processor contracts, data sharing, policies and procedures, etc. And I think where we got to was our other rights requests, I believe. So we got through effectively the first, however many that is, five or six last time. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what we mean by other rights requests and particularly why that categorization might be as opposed to it just being specific rights requests?
Yeah, sure. So I think the reason why it's not just specific rights requests and reason we haven't also done all rights requests is because, well, SARs tend to be, as you can see from that slide that Ollie just put on there, SARs tend to be a very popular category that come in, a category of questions. So other rights requests can be right to erase or removal of consent, restriction of processing, objection to processing. It can be anything, any of the other rights other than a subject access request in that category. The key ones that we tend to see are a right to erasure or removal of consent. So it's usually with right to erasure, it will be, you know, an individual's written into us asking that we delete all their data. Do we have to do this? We want to keep some of their data. What do we do? And essentially the starting point for me is, well, you need to look at whether the right applies, because it's a qualified right, it doesn't apply to all processing. So if there's obviously any of the criteria for the right to erasure which applies, then you're going to need to carry out the right if there's no other exemptions you can rely on. So the circumstances in which the right applies are if the personal data is no longer needed, if there's been a withdrawal of consent, if there's been an objection to the processing with no overriding legitimate interest, that's if you're relying obviously on legitimate interests. If there's been an objection to direct marketing, if the data has been unlawfully processed, if you need to erase the data to comply with a legal obligation, or if the personal data is in relation to information society services to a child. So if any of those criteria do not apply, then essentially you don't need to erase the data. Quite often you'll find you'll need to keep the data for some of the instances. So say you're an employee or an ex-employee, you may need to keep that data for legal reasons, for example, for your tax database systems with HMRC, etc. So yeah, it's a situation. It was a bit of an echo, I think, Ollie. Not sure. But yeah, so essentially it's about looking, does it apply? That right, and if not, then you don't need to action it. And then you've got the removal of consent, which is a slightly different situation in which removal of consent is an unconditional right. So if you've got a request to withdraw consent and you've been relying on consent as a basis for the processing, then you have to carry out that right, because that's the whole point of relying on consent, is that consent is freely given and it can be withdrawn at any time. So that's slightly different in that case, and it has to be actioned. But the thing to bear in mind is that it does not then invalidate any previous processing on the basis of consent. That consent was still valid until the point in which it was withdrawn. So that's something to be aware of as well.
Yeah, there's no Ekar just going to spawn in is all.
Oh, cool.
Unfortunately, you're very much taking after Dave in that you're both very difficult to get a word in edgeways when you get going. All I was going to say is, I don't know about you, Dave, whether you see this a lot, but I know that Zara and I see a huge amount of this, which is particularly in housing circles, although not exclusively, where you get effectively a tenant or a customer who has maybe done something they shouldn't have done or said something that they shouldn't have done, or there's maybe suspicions around their activity potentially. We see a lot of fraud cases or potential fraud cases, and people write and say, oh, could you erase all my records, please? And it's sort of a case of, well, no, we're investigating you for fraud. We're not just gonna erase all your records because you've asked us to. I don't know if you see any of that, but we get quite a bit of it through.
Yeah, and I have seen some. Obviously, just the one, if you're investigating them for fraud, you would say that you can't erase the data because there's a legal obligation, not necessarily that you're investigating them for fraud.
So you didn't kind of alert them off.
So I do see it. I've seen it come across. Quite interestingly, it links back to some of the news items around TPS and PECA fines, with how many people actually know that kind of an objection to email marketing or an unsubscribe is considered to be removing consent for direct marketing purposes, and whether it's actually logged as such or whether it just lets the system do it and you update the database and you don't necessarily do anything else with it. But so the removing consent for direct marketing purposes is really interesting, because I'm just wondering sometimes how many people actually officially recognize it as a removal of consent. But otherwise, yes, I would agree. The main ones are the main ones that we see, which is stars, erasure requests, that kind of thing. And absolutely, if you're needing the data, we've sometimes seen it where can you please remove my data from the system?
I'm back, sorry, just had a bit of a clip.
Can you remove my details from the system, that kind of thing? But there's usually an overriding legal objective, whether it's, like you say, for tax purposes, that kind of thing. You've got HMRC obligations, so you need to retain the data in line with your retention period for those set periods. Or in fact, what I've sometimes seen as well is when individuals ask for the details to be deleted, and it's fundamental to the performance of a contract to which they are subject. So for example, an employee may be requesting information to be deleted in relation to their employment. In that sense, so you've got to make sure that you work your way through, and I think Zara is right. Yeah. It's one of those that you've got to understand fully. But if we're going to say that we're not going to action a raise request, then we're still under a duty to inform them of the reasons why, unless, as we mentioned earlier, that was going to tip something off.
Yeah, and I think we'll come back to talk a little bit about direct marketing, which you mentioned there, Dave, in a bit, because that's one of our topics, which is also one of our more frequently asked questions. The one thing that I just wanted to raise on this, which I think is interesting, is you do tend to see a quite significant imbalance in the exercise of rights. Obviously, we talk about SARs all the time. We do talk about erasure requests a lot, occasionally objections. But how often do you ever receive portability requests? How often do you ever receive restriction requests? I mean, obviously, a restriction request is contingent on other factors, but I tend to wonder why that is, whether it's just that they're not understood, whether it's that they're less useful potentially. I don't know, but
yeah, don't forget that
you definitely do see that imbalance.
You do, and I think possibly partly because of how some of them work. So if you look at portability, for example, portability, in essence, if you look at it, is kind of a weakened version of a SAR, because you're asking for your information that's being processed under consent or contract, I believe, and it's only electronic information that you've provided or was able to provide to the organization. So it's not as far reaching and far as wide as a subject access request. In essence, though, the essence of portability is, just using a basic example, that you've got your gas and electric with one gas company, and you want to move from gas company A to gas company B, and you feel that by moving your usage records to gas company B that you may get a more favourable rate because you'll be able to work out your usage better. And I think that's where portability kind of comes into its own. So it doesn't, as a right, it's limited in how it's whether it's a valid request for portability in that sense. So do work through those criteria, but if it is a valid request, then you may find that you're in one of the sectors where portability really works. I've never really come across it with a lot of my clients, because it's not really something that would be exercised within those sectors.
Very topical to talk of you to talk about gas consumption at this juncture of you know, where we are in the news cycle and all that sort of stuff. No, but I think you're right. I think you're right. And also, I suspect it's one of those rights which is exercised a lot, but not under the guise of portability. People just ask, can you just, you know, forward my records on or whatever? Or could you facilitate this transfer, as you said, from one provider to another? No one actually really spells out the need to, you know, apply the right of portability. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting. Zara spoke a lot about consent in that piece there, because obviously the right to erasure is going to be linked to that in some instances. And that sort of begs a bigger question, which is the use of lawful basis full stop, on which lawful basis we get to use. Now, to be honest with you, I thought this would be higher up our list. It comes in at 8th overall, I think, give or take.
Yeah.
And I thought this would be higher because I feel like lawful bases and determining the correct ones are sort of really frequently recurring questions that sort of go to the heart of a lot of what we do. Are we able to use consent? Do we use a legitimate interest X, Y, Z? But it only comes in sort of lower down the list, Sarah.
Yeah, I wonder if it's because it gets mentioned in a huge chunk of what we do, but it probably gets mentioned in a case which is more to do with data sharing and then just ensuring there's a lawful basis in place, rather than a question outrightly asking, you know, we need a lawful basis for this processing. What should we do? What can we rely on? That's my theory, at least, because I know we touch on it an awful lot. But I think one of the key issues for people who don't necessarily know too much about data protection is there's this assumption that you must have consent to process data, that you need to the data subject to consent to it before you can do anything with the data, which isn't the case. Consent is one of six lawful bases under Article 6 of the UK GDPR, and sometimes it's not really appropriate to be relied upon, and it's a very tricky one also to rely upon, because you need to be aware that obviously by relying on consent, that means the data subject must be able to also withdraw their consent. Can you handle that? If a data subject were to withdraw their consent, can you delete all that data that you're holding? And if it's not appropriate for you to do that, then consent probably isn't the right basis to be relying upon. And that's something that we do try to stress, because I feel like a lot of times organizations assume that consent is what they need to rely upon, but it's not really the best basis for them. So it's something to really consider for organizations. Alternatively, another basis that gets used a lot is legitimate interests, which is it's a very flexible basis which you can use a lot of the time. But I think something that's really been brought to light is the importance of having a legitimate interest assessment to document that you are able to rely on it, that you do have a overriding legitimate interest, and that on top of that you've given sufficient consideration to the rights of data subjects. I mean, David, I don't know if you remember from a couple of weeks ago, there was this case of a German bank, I don't think the bank's been named, who were fined €900,000 for basically extending the basis of legitimate interest too far by doing lots of work on data analytics and enriching the data too far. And there wasn't enough balancing of the individual's rights, and that if a sufficient legitimate interest assessment were to be carried out, that would have been the outcome that would have been come to, and therefore a basis of legitimate interest wouldn't have been applied. So it does demonstrate that when you rely on legitimate interest, there does need to be consideration of the rights of the data subject, and if you are stretching it too far by relying on legitimate interests.
Yes, I would fully agree with that. From the bits that I've seen around lawful basis, because again, I would have thought, to be fair, it would have possibly been higher up. So I'll probably concur with you, Ollie. I would have thought it's possibly been higher up in that sense. But I sometimes wonder, and whether Zara's got kind of insights on this as well, is whether overall some of the lawful bases that individuals identify potentially on the rope and so on and so forth are maybe quite obvious, so the obvious ones are the obvious ones that they're happy with, maybe not fully gone through the process with legitimate interest, but also because of that possibly getting a little bit of confidence and then maybe misapplying some of the lawful bases and therefore not necessarily picking up on it as an issue until your ROPAs are reviewed by the DPO or your privacy office for somebody. So just for example, we still occasionally come across, and I don't know if you've seen this through the support desk, you'll occasionally come across a contract with a data subject where there's a consent statement on it.
Mm, that, I've, yeah. Yeah, we also see sometimes performance of a contract, but the data subject isn't party to the contract. It's a contract between two organizations where they need to do something, but the data subject's not party for it, so therefore it contract doesn't apply.
Yeah, my favorite will forever be the you have to agree to these terms and conditions, or you have to provide your consent to the processing or whatever it might be. You have to agree to this privacy policy. They're all absolute standout classics from my perspective. Steph's picked out, and nice to see you, Steph, something from the Easy Life information that we were talking about before, which apparently a clip from the, I assume from the ICO's enforcement notice, but it reads as follows. Easy Life stated that a former employee who had previously been a blank, i.e. redacted, had advised it that the consent statement was a sufficient basis for the sales activity carried out for it to be compliant, which is interesting on a number of grounds. One, obviously, we're talking about consent and the fact that they thought that they had some sort of consent statement. So I don't know what that looks like because I've not looked at it, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's the type of thing where they read out a short statement and said, by continuing this call, you consent to it, something to that effect. But also, why on earth are they redacting what is clearly the word DPO? Sorry to spoil the fun. Vaughan, Steph and I have been going at it in the chat, but it's clearly the word DPO that's been redacted there and they're trying to blame, well, at least from my perspective. I don't know if either of you two have picked up on that. You were engaged in that conversation while I was in the chat. But interesting, because you do often see that idea of, you know, organizations saying, well, we thought we had consent, or, you know, we believe we've got consent for this, and they just quite obviously have got it completely wrong.
Well, that's what I mean, and whether they're actually applying the lawful basis correctly. Because let's not forget, if you've got an employment contract with an individual, then the processing of information that's pertinent to the contract can be under contractual grounds, either steps taken to enter into a contract or for the performance of that contract. But we still see consent sometimes on these various different consent statements, how they're worded, and picking up on a couple of the versions that you've aired there. I can't remember when it was, but there's a very strong case back from, and you probably remember this when I mentioned it, there was a fine of €125,000 by the Greek Data Protection Authority on PricewaterhouseCoopers for doing that very thing, for having consent within an employment contract. So it's just whether necessarily being misapplied. And that also comes down to, there is some guidance, and it's worth definitely digging out the guidance, having a look around what you can actually limit or what the contract, if you're processing under contract, should be limited to, because it's certainly the guidance, I think it's from the European Data Protection Board, possibly limits the use of contracts to the performance of the contract and not ancillary things. So in essence, if the contract can't be performed without that processing, then it's under contract. But if it's kind of loosely tied to contract, then you maybe need to start thinking about different lawful bases in that sense. So those are just a couple of thoughts, and those are a couple of bits that I've come up with, I've come across on site, shall we say, when we're dealing with clients, and not necessarily through the support desk, but very, very similar in nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And that throws up the interesting question, because you do see it a lot of when you bring like DBS or criminal records checks into it. And then sort of, I've seen instances where they go, well, we need this to be able to provide you with your employment contract, therefore we do it on the basis of performance of a contract or steps taken to enter into it. Mm-hmm. But obviously under Article 10, you need a different basis for processing criminal records. So it just throws up some interesting queries. Cara's really on it today and has put that Greek decision straight in, Dave. So it's there for you if you wanted to go and consult it. Thanks again. The issue around consent is an interesting one, because obviously a lot of the time what that throws up is that your privacy information is not right. And I'm segueing seamlessly into our next topic. God, Zara, you're impressed, aren't you?
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time, the main thing is, if your privacy information is right, if your privacy statement is right, if you're being completely transparent, you can get consent for most things, really. I mean, it's a case of consent will not always be appropriate, of course, but my view tends to be that you can use it pretty extensively as long as you're being transparent. Because people come to me and say, oh, can we do this? Can we do that? Well, if you got consent for it, crack on. So the privacy information piece is particularly relevant, particularly important, and yet as something which is not massively complicated, because all of the requisite information is set out there in Articles 13 and 14, we still see a lot of them that aren't right.
Yeah, we do. And it is one of those things that it tells you what you need to include in your privacy policy. So when people still aren't, you know, sometimes you go online. I mean, sometimes organisations don't even have a privacy notice, which obviously is a whole other issue altogether. But, you know, the requirements are what needs to be there just to make sure that you're being transparent with data subjects and so that they can understand it. There's also things you need to consider about, you know, how transparent, how easy is it for people to understand what's in the privacy notice? Are children or young adults meant potentially going to be looking at this notice? Will they be able to understand it? So that's something you also need to consider when devising this. You know, how user friendly is it? Obviously, the more easy it is for people, just everyday people, to be able to understand what's going on, the better it's going to be. Quite often, it's easy as someone that looks at data protection day in, day out, to kind of use all this data protection jargon and formulate it in a way that it sounds very, you know, proper and complicated, but it's not really appropriate to be using that kind of language when you're just speaking to the general public really in a privacy information. So it's important to consider that, and also how you're going to make it available to people, how you're going to bring it to their attention. If you're going to be contacting people, if it's the first time you're going to be contacting people, how are you going to be directing them to a privacy notice in that instance? And also just considering, what else was I going to mention? Also just considering as well, if you're going to have a layered privacy approach, are you going to have, for example, with CCTV, are you going to have, you know, a signage on site which lets people know of the CCTV that's taking place and where they can find more information about that? What information will be included in it? In that approach, would you just have the name of the controller and a link to your privacy policy? You're going to talk about the purposes of the processing. You're going to talk about people's rights in relation to the processing. It's a lot of things that need to be considered in taking a layered approach. But it's just ultimately to ensure that data subjects have this information made available to them, and that they're able to understand it in a way that works best for them, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I would agree. Talking about privacy information, I'm wondering whether Zara's looking at my list, because as she was reading through it, I was thinking, well, that's a point I was going to raise, and she's covered it. That's a point I was going to raise, and she's covered it. In that sense, so I think you've covered most of the points in there. Just going back a step, you probably could do most things under consent if you had it worded properly, but don't forget we can't bundle consent, and consent has still got to be valid. So if as long as you've got the mechanisms for consent and everything in there, and you're not bundling consents, then that's going to be fine. Just picking up on a point that Zara's mentioned, in the fullness of everything, don't forget there's an obligation under Article 13 and Article 14 for privacy information, on depending whether you're obtaining information directly from the data subject or from another kind of person. So it's how we address those points as well, and whether you've come across that within the support desk.
Yeah, well, we do get asked a lot about, so the thing I see a lot of is, particularly when you are dealing with instances where people are buying data potentially, or sourcing information that is quote unquote publicly available, i.e. you're scouring LinkedIn for people or whatever it might be. You see it a lot in fundraising, obviously. Dave, you'll know about that. But maybe where you're doing sort of wealth screening stuff, where you're doing sort of targeting high net worth individuals, then how do you make sure that privacy information has been properly communicated to them, all that sort of stuff? That's where I tend to see, particularly when you're talking about Article 14 and at what point you have to deliver that information, it tends to come in that context more than anything. I don't know about you, Zara, but we definitely do see that. And then obviously, you know, not wanting to segue away, but the issue of privacy information then comes up in CCTV, which is the next point. But it's sort of anything else on that from either of you?
I was just going to say it's important to be aware that obviously if you're planning on undertaking any new processing, then you need to reflect that in your privacy notice. You need to make sure it's a live document that you're constantly updating, so that it reflects all the processing that you're carrying out as an organisation. So that's something to also be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. Dave, any thoughts? Or do we want to talk about CCTV, which I think is the bane of DPOs across the housing sector, really? But we'll talk about that in a second.
No, for sure. I think, again, any points had on privacy, I think Zara's just ticked them off. So well done, Zara.
Sorry, Dave.
I guess, I guess if you wanted a link to CCTV, well, you'll still need privacy information around CCTV.
Well, precisely. And we do get asked about this a lot. And it's something which is... The thing is with CCTV, I feel, although this may not necessarily be true, is that it does very much tend to be all or nothing. You get businesses with no CCTV or very limited, and then others who have gone absolutely mad on it. I mean, obviously, housing's a big one because you're not talking about just your immediate office space. You're also looking at your housing stock. And also, you'll have issues like antisocial behaviour, all sorts, fly tipping, which I suppose is also ASB. But you know what I mean, which it tends to spiral. And it's something which, if not properly managed, can spiral very easily. And then you get into all sorts of, you know, a real quagmire potentially of trying to sort it out. And I mean, you will have seen this up and down the country, Dave, presumably.
Yeah, CCTV is one that seems a bit unfair, but it's one of the ones, if you're undertaking an audit, it's usually one of the areas that you can normally find issues with, unfortunately. And I don't necessarily mean that negatively, but I agree. I think it's just one of those areas where it's probably been in. You've probably got a bit of a kind of a legacy system possibly going on. And when you start thinking and you start asking questions around, have you got appropriate kind of inventories of your CCTV? Are the pan, tilt, zoom? Are they fixed? Are they working? Are they not working? Are the dummy cameras? Where is the information recorded to? Is it in the cloud? How is it protected? Is it on site? Is it protected? Through to, well, okay, let's have a look. Let's see if you've had a serious incident and the police are wanting the footage because there's a high chance that somebody's going to end up going to court for an offence, that kind of thing. Looking at appropriate management of footage under serious requests in order not to jeopardise the request, in order to make sure that there's not everybody's looking at it. It won't be the first time where I've seen serious incidents within organisations where the CCTV is pored over by anybody who can get their hands on it to see what happened.
Yeah, for sure. I tell you the other thing, obviously, we tend to see, or there was a real explosion of it. I do feel like it's died off a little bit, but there was a period where you couldn't move for instances of tenants having Ring doorbells in place and it creating complaints and issues and disputes. We've spoken about it a number of times on here, but there was a real sort of peak of that. Maybe it's still ongoing, and I suspect it is to an extent, but I feel like we don't hear about it quite so much anymore. Maybe it's the case that landlords up and down the country have gone to grips with the issue and maybe have sort of started to contain it, but there's a huge amount of that, and we still get instances of occasionally Lisa's time is still very much a problem, and DC, hello DC, saying body worn camera technology often gets forgotten about, which is very true, but we still get people calling in, private citizens calling into our sort of info app number saying my neighbor's got all these cameras up, what can I do about XYZ? So still very much an issue, and we do get asked about it a lot. And then, as you say, Dave, then you get into the territory of talking about disclosures, you know, what you can and can't share. Unfortunately, in housing there are going to be a number of police investigations along the way, so there's that to consider. There's also instances more broadly than in housing where you talk about monitoring people in the workplace and what you can and can't do in that respect, because I've had organizations say, oh, well, as it stands, we, you know, film people at their desk. And it's sort of like, right, okay, are you sure you should be doing that?
For sure.
So you do get all sorts.
Or you may also, and I have come across this, inwardly facing dash cams for organisations that are running fleet vehicles.
Yes, yeah.
As well as external dash cams, but inwardly facing. So then you're looking into driver behaviour, that kind of thing, whilst doing the cab and whilst they're driving the vehicle.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, as Vaughan points out, you know, there's the list is endless. You're talking about phones, computers, cameras, etc., drones, increasingly. I absolutely love what Ben's just put. Maybe I don't have a social life, but as a DPO, I have a DPIA for my home domestic CCTV system. Mm-hmm. That is fabulous. I love to hear that. I've got a lot of time for it. People are talking about cameras a lot. Clearly, it's an mm-hmm. issue that's not gone away. Residents in care homes getting Nest doorbells, all that sort of stuff. We've seen it all. I mean, we had one where, I think I can talk about this, but we had an issue where a resident in a care home, their family had put in some sort of Amazon tablet that allowed them to be, the family could tap into that because there was a camera on it and keep an eye on their sort of elderly relative in care. But then obviously you've got support workers coming in and out to sort of, you know, administer care, etc. And there's sort of an issue around them being monitored. So it can be extremely difficult. I know this is primarily about housing and that's not the intention right now, but it's one of the areas we see the most of it. But it does translate to a number of other businesses because it's going to be by no means just housing that have to deal with this. And we see it all the time. Although it must be said, I'm sure people will agree with me on this, that our regulator is seemingly far less concerned with CCTV than European regulators. The Spanish in particular, the APD, Dave, I think are particularly hot on CCTV related enforcement. They seem to be fining sort of homeowners associations every other week, as far as I can tell.
They do appear more proactive in the area than our own regulator currently stands. But yeah, interesting. All interesting stuff around CCTV. There's you're absolutely right. I think when you start looking at CCTV, we need to expand kind of the term CCTV from the traditional camera on a pole through to everything that's come up in the chat around body worn cameras, in care homes, ring doorbells, dash cams, that kind of thing, inwardly facing, outwardly facing dash cams, that kind of thing. So it's CCTV, but I think we need to broaden it now through the explosion of technology and the fact that more or less everybody's walking around with the camera in the pocket that's capable of filming somebody.
Well, there's also that, yeah, because if you're an operative in a housing scheme and you go around to, you know, do something and someone's filming you constantly, again, how do you deal with that? Jasmine's saying that they're having to go through the process of working out how they manage footage sent in by their tenants accepting that video. My view on this, and I'm happy to be challenged, Dave, if you feel otherwise, but my view tends to be, if you receive footage in from a tenant, first things first, is it quite obviously criminal or does it relate to a criminal matter? If it is, just get them to send it to police. There's no need for you guys to hold that, you know, it's of no value to you. If it's under criminal, but your housing officer that's responsible for them has enough context to know that it's going to be valuable, maybe retain it, but otherwise try and get as rid of as much as possible, in my view, and try not to keep very much of it, because the problem is you end up building up these sort of banks of evidence and then someone puts in a SAR and all of a sudden it's a bit of a nightmare. I don't know, Dave, what your view, or Zara for that matter, what your view on it is, but It's important to sort of set your policy and stick to it, as I said, regardless of what that policy ends up being.
I would generally agree. I would have said if somebody sends you CCTV on video footage and there's clearly an illegal act occurring, it really ought to be in the hands of the police, not the housing association or your employer in that sense. The bits that are under the radar are not quite, so it might just be kind of low scale issues of antisocial behaviour. I would probably agree with yourself, set your policy, determine whether it's what you want, what you don't want, bearing in mind if you do accept it, then you're going to be caught by the provisions of the GDPR in that sense, because you're using video footage for the purpose of identifying somebody, so then it'll definitely be caught as personal data, and then your retention periods and everything else and all the rest of the compliance comes into play. So I wouldn't necessarily find myself disagreeing with what you said there, Ollie.
So that'd be my two cents, but happy to talk about in greater detail off air, Jasmine, if you want. I'm conscious of time. We've got two more points really that we need to run through, and one of them is a pretty chunky one that we've already mentioned, direct marketing. The chunky one is international data transfers, and again, this is one which I might have expected to be higher up the list, although then again, we're sort of far enough now from Schrems 2 that maybe, I mean, around that time, obviously 90% of our traffic was to do with the ramifications of Schrems 2, what that would mean, then subsequently Brexit, etc. I think we possibly have turned the corner on that. But Zara, how much do you get through on this still, and what are some of the key issues that you come across?
To be fair, with international data transfers, we don't, as you say, we don't get too much. It probably is a case of, you know, we've had Brexit, we've had Schrems 2, so they're the key things that kind of brought it to everyone's attention. I get it a lot when it's usually when I'm doing something like due diligence on an organization, and I'll quite often see a reference to the US Privacy Shield And I have to remind people, no, this has been out of this has been, what's it called, deemed inadequate since July 2020, which is obviously over 2 years ago. So this needs to go, and it can't be relied upon either for an international data transfer. There's also been a recent update. Me and Phil and Shah talked about it briefly in a podcast a couple of weeks ago, in that if you're going to be having an international data transfer, you can no longer enter into that transfer under the old EU SECs with an international data transfer addendum. You need to have an international data transfer agreement in place. So that's something to just be aware of if you're planning on using any new processes, organizations overseas where there isn't an adequacy decision, that an international data transfer agreement needs to be in place.
Yeah, absolutely. You were even doing TROs the other week.
Yeah, I had a bit. Yeah, I spoke about that also briefly on the podcast. But yeah, if you're going to be having an international data transfer agreement in place, you also need to undertake a transfer risk assessment or an international data transfer risk assessment. And they are quite long. And Ollie, unfortunately, had to look through it all as well once I'd done it. So I'm sure he can. Well, also, I know Ollie's done some as well. I'm sure Dave has as well. But they are quite long, and they can take a good chunk of time and a lot of research. But it needs to be done to make sure that. Well, it's a bit of an echo. I don't know.
No, you're okay. Don't worry. All I was going to say is, not wanting to expose Dave, I'm not sure he has actually done any transfer risk assessments. Have you, Dave?
No, I haven't actually.
There we go.
So I'll be coming to Zara for some training. you're right around the IDTAs. Covering off, if you are still operating under the old EU SECs from when we were part of Europe, I think they still run through. I can't remember the exact date, but it's some date in 2024,
yes,
I believe.
Right.
I think March 2024, I believe.
Yeah, from which then you're going to have to convert off to the new version. So if you're currently running on them and you can still rely on them, but you're time bound in that sense. I guess the part that I find generally is the fact that there's a bit of an over-reliance on standard contractual clauses, in the sense that, there's a transfer to the US, we've got standard contractual clauses in place, that's it, we're fine, aren't we, in that kind of sense. And there's probably an over-reliance on them. They're certainly not saying the SECs aren't appropriate, but all the evidence suggests you can't just rely on them in isolation. You need to do other bits of work with them.
I'd like to revoke that. That's not what I thought you meant. you are absolutely right. What I thought you were going to say is that the exceptions for transfers are seldom looked at, I find. Not that they're massively applicable, but obviously you can transfer data if you have the explicit consent of the individual. You can do it if it's needed for the performance of a contract, X, Y, Z. There are reasons you can do it. And I don't think they get used very much, if at all. I've recently been, well, I think it's been a while now. I think I mentioned it on an earlier episode, but I've played with using explicit consent for it. As far as I'm aware, it works, although, you know, if anyone's got any thoughts on that, I'm happy to hear them. Ben's right. I mean, people are still confused by the IDTA and addendum. It's not helpful that the acronyms are the same at all. People are confused. I feel like I've got my head around it, but that's probably because I deal with it day in, day out. So explaining it to someone who maybe doesn't have that exposure or doesn't necessarily need that exposure could be tricky. I don't think there's any further guidance, Ben, as far as I'm aware. We could do with some, let's be honest. And I think overall the processes around this need to be refined. It's still a very tricky area, and one that we do get asked about a lot. And that's going to continue as long as, you know, we are trading without sort of any adequacy agreement with our American counterparts. And
there'll be something politically coming eventually, won't they, in order to facilitate
of course.
It? And then I guess naturally you'll get Schrems 3 possibly following that as well.
All I was going to say is that it may yet get worse if, which we've not, you know, we've not spoken about this yet, because honestly, I don't think it's worth the oxygen expended to talk about it, but more plans from the DCMS to overhaul our privacy regime. It's all just hot air at this point, isn't it? I mean, but you know, if anything did like that did go ahead, then again, it would probably only further complicate our arrangements for international transfers.
No, for sure. And you know, I like a little bit of political bashing, and I'm trying to avoid political bashing. And I sometimes wonder whether because the current government and prime minister is having such a caning that they're trying to rally the old guard around Brexit and trying to get a bit more support internally because there's too much infighting and that kind of thing. And I wonder whether that was kind of one of the things that was rolled out to try and get a bit of consistency within the party as opposed to fighting within the party. Not saying I necessarily agree with it. I'd personally welcome a complete election in order to get a change, because I think it's getting a bit boring now, the fact that they can't achieve anything. Personally, but moving on from the politics, whether they've got the time to push that through before 2024, with everything else that's going on with the war in Ukraine, with increased energy prices, with the parliamentary time that's left in that sense, and any other legislative agendas that they've got to push through, it may get traction. It depends on how important the seat is in light of everything else that they've got to deal with. So it's still one to watch.
Well, precisely. And considering that any business that trades with Europe is probably going to have to be GDPR compliant anyway, it seems like a complete and utter waste of time. But, you know, that's...
No, for sure. The cynic in me would be saying, if you wanted to help facilitate business and trade, then surely keeping it the same would be better than rewriting fundamentally the rest of the law and ditching the billions that have been spent on getting it right the first time around. But then again, I'm just being cynical.
Yes. And on that note, let's move swiftly on to our final topic with a minute to go, but we'll overrun ever so slightly. We've done quite well to leave the soapbox in the cupboard for the past few weeks, but it was always going to make a reappearance eventually.
It's been hard to suppress it.
Yeah, I can tell. I could tell it was coming, to be honest with you. The way you started today's episode, Dave, I was like, oh, I think this is going to be coming eventually. you entered with real gusto. So our final point, we've already spoken about it a little bit, but let's just sort of close the loop on it, so to speak. Direct marketing, Zara, tell us a little bit about why we get asked about it, what that relates to, you know, what are some of the common queries, that sort of thing.
Yeah, direct marketing is actually probably my favourite part of data protection law, just because it's a very grey area. It's quite tricky, and I think just I like the fact that there's a lot of scope for interpretation on it, and it's not necessarily entirely black and white. But we tend to get just cases of organisations who maybe want to send out newsletters by email, or send out just emails in general of updates necessarily to their customers, to their tenants. And they come to us and say, you know, we want to send this to everyone. Is this direct marketing? Do we need consent? And it can be quite tricky trying to figure out, is it promoting the aims and ideals of the organization? Is it encouraging any further action from the reader? Is it trying to persuade their thoughts or anything like that that could be deemed to be direct marketing? Or is it purely informative to the reader? And that determination is not an easy one to make, and it's something that you have to kind of throw around and really think about kind of what the overall purpose of the message is. And the tricky thing with direct marketing as well is that if one part of the email, one part of the document it's sending out by email, by SMS, by any electronic means, is deemed to be marketing information, then PECO and direct marketing apply to the whole communication. So from there, if you're not sure, or if you think it will, then there needs to be a decision of, well, what's the response by the organisation. If you're not entirely sure, because sometimes you do have to say, We're not certain on this. We're kind of a bit on the edge. It could be, it could not be. It's not entirely clear. What's the organisation going to do in response to that? What's within their risk appetite? Alternatively, you can always just choose to just deliver the information by post, and then, you know, you're not going to be triggering PECA, and you can just send it under legitimate interest, and then that's fine. Or you could choose to only disclose this information to people who have consented to receiving marketing information via that channel. But it's a decision for organizations to make really on that basis. I enjoy it because I just like the fact that you can pick it apart, and you really have to kind of get into the purpose of the messaging.
I would fully agree with everything that you said there. Zara, I think one of the key things, I mean, you're going to get a spectrum in any case. You're going to get some which is clearly direct marketing, And so obvious it's direct marketing, it's not necessarily going to trip you up. Then you get some on the other side of the spectrum, which is clearly not direct marketing in any way means in chips. I mean, so for example, simple customer queries and customer management, that kind of thing. But then when you get the ones in the middle where it is direct marketing, isn't it, and you're on the fence and you've got all these other considerations to take in place, it can sometimes be difficult because, like you say, parts of a newsletter may be direct marketing, parts of a newsletter may not be direct marketing, but it's not considering the newsletter itself. Sometimes you have to dig a little bit deeper than that and start looking at the content and the language used within the piece. So if it's a bland piece of communication, it's not really trying to drive anything, it's not trying to enthuse people, that kind of thing, then it may likely be less considered to be direct marketing. I'm not saying it isn't, but maybe considered less likely. But when you start looking at the intricacies of direct marketing and you're looking at the language of direct marketing, and it's all filled with things like nudge theories and people like you are also doing this, that kind of thing, you really need to understand that you need to also consider within all of that the content and language used in that sense to try and drive people to do something, because the whole essence of direct marketing is to try and get people to respond, that kind of thing. So you're absolutely right. If you're not sure, obviously consider the channel posts is a lot easier. You've only got the GDPR considerations to think about. If you're doing it through electronic, then you've got the GDPR and PECA to consider, as you say, with whether you're doing electronic marketing through email, telephone, SMS, or otherwise. I find it a really fascinating area. I used to work in direct marketing in that sense, and it's still an area that fascinates me. There was some guidance. I'm not sure actually whether the ICO's guidance, it's maybe one that's still on hold somewhere. I don't know if you remember the ICO's guidance on direct marketing, statutory code of practice, or the guidance on direct marketing was amended, and in there it was even saying things like formal communications I just can't think of the term that's in my head, sorry, but certain communications from organizations may be deemed like from the council may also be deemed direct marketing. But I'm led to believe the whole guidance was put on pause. It wasn't actually it went through the process, and there was some disagreement between the ICO and Parliament, and I don't think it actually became a fully endorsed copy. I'm not sure where, if that has, if anybody is aware that it has, is now a fully endorsed copy or not, then please let me know. But I'm aware it's kind of held in suspense. If anybody would like to kind of correct me on that one.
No, I think you're right. I think it is still in limbo. Just before we conclude and to sort of really close the... Yeah, still in suspense. Just to really close the loop on all this, I agree with what Steph's saying in the chat, which is that this easy life ruling that we mentioned right at the start is an interesting, you know, departure for the ICO, in that previously when they've done enforcement, they've looked at only the PECA side of things. You know, we can clearly prove that you've sent this many messages without consent, you've, you know, phoned this many numbers on the TPS, and therefore it comes under the lower fine regime. Interesting now to see that they've sort of gone a step beyond that to say, you know, actually there's more at play here, and there are some GDPR contraventions thrown in terms of invisible processing, probably profiling they shouldn't have been doing, X, Y, Z, lack of consent, and therefore then moving into the sort of higher fine regimes associated with the GDPR. So sure. Completely in agreement with Steph on that. Interesting to see.
And let's just on that, let's not forget that if the reforms do go through with debt protection laws, that will also, or under the old version, unless it changes, they're also looking at increasing PECA fines to the level of the GDPR, weren't they? So
yes, quite. Any further thoughts, Dave, before we conclude? Because we're already a good couple of minutes over and we need to record the intro to this.
No, I think, shall we leave it there before I find another box to stand on?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a terrifically good idea. So on that note, I would like to thank you both, Dave and Zara, for your time and insights this afternoon, and for joining me for this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Thank you once again to all those who have attended here live with us today. We very much enjoyed having you with us. It's always best to have a busy session. Thanks to all those listening back afterwards. I say, if you'd like to join the live sessions, get in touch with us on any of our socials. You get an invite to the live session. We are back next week with producer Miles. I'm going to say, is it Barry's episode next week? Or is that the week after?
It is, yeah. So we've got Barry Malt joining us to discuss the recent changes in the data security protection toolkit.
Excellent. So if you're in the healthcare sector, you won't want to miss that. Barry's a fabulous guest. And if you're not in healthcare, it's still interesting to see how governance operates in different sectors. As I say, we love chatting to Barry, so we're very excited about that. Come and join us live once again, same time, same place, Microsoft Teams. It's all free, 12:30 from Friday lunchtime. And on that note, I hope you all have a lovely weekend despite the weather, and we look forward to catching up with you all very soon.
All the best. Thank you, everybody. Take care.
Right. See you.